serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode marking 75 years since the Battle of Iwo Jima. Let's get right into another survivor's story. Carl Appel was just 19 years old in February 1945.
Well, we were, floating reserve, and at night we'd pull away from the island, and then in the mornings we'd pull back in close enough that we could see the shore and we could see planes diving down and little dots running around on the island. It appeared that we were, inflicting quite a bit of damage. But then word came through the onboard speakers that we were going to be called in because of the terrible casualties that the Marines were taking at that time. So we boarded the landing craft, and the balance of the 3rd Division landed on D plus 5.
Well, and as you describe being in floating reserve and being able to see what's happening, you know, the question that comes to my mind, and probably a lot of people listening, is did you see that one thing that so many people have seen since, because it's probably the most famous photograph of all time, the Marines lifting the flag atop Mount Suribachi, the second flag. There had been a smaller one put up earlier. Did you happen to see a Stars and Stripes flying atop the mountain?
Yeah, we saw the flag. We didn't actually see the raising of the flag, but we did see it when it was up there. That certainly lifted our spirits a great deal.
Was that misleading at all? Did it make you think that your side had made more progress than they really had?
Well, not necessarily. We knew that Suribachi was a real difficult thing to take. That flag, when they put it up, they were still receiving fire from the Japanese in caves and so forth, were still entrenched in the Mount Suribachi.
So you see that from the ship, then they've got you 5 days after the initial landing, they have you on this landing craft going into the shore. So why don't we pick up the story there? What was that teenage Marine seeing, hearing?
They held us off for a while for some reason. I guess the landing shore or beaches were so jammed with destroyed vehicles and landing craft that they had to clear enough space for us to get in. And when we went in, of course, they dropped the ramp and we went ashore. And of course, there's a series of terraces from the beach up to the main part of the island. And I'm sure most of you can relate to running in sand. You take one step forward and you can go slide back too. So it's quite a challenge to get up to a place where we're on the level and could get into some cover. We progressed up to airfield number 1, where we dug in for the night. And during the night, we received some artillery shells in and around the airfield there. Fortunately, I was able to get into a foxhole that had already been dug, thanks to another Marine somewhere. And so I got in that foxhole and put my poncho over me. Then, of course, we'd get these shells in here. Unfortunately, none landed in my hole.
Did they land in some other people's holes?
Not to my knowledge. I did hear that there were some casualties, but I didn't see it or witness it at all. And the following morning, we moved up to a position of what they called immediate reserve, just behind the main line. When moving up, I saw my first dead Marine. I remember observing him, and apparently he had been standing on the edge of a foxhole, or shell hole, I should say. And when he was hit, he just fell straight back. I remember looking at his lacings on his leggings and just thinking to myself that when you lace those, you didn't think that you were going to end up like this. And in looking at him a little closer, he had been hit directly in the head and clenched in his fingers of his right hand was the stub of a cigarette. And apparently he had been standing up next to that hole smoking, and the Japanese aimed at that cigarette glow and hit him right in the head.
That's got to get your attention and make you wonder what's going to happen to you.
Yes, yes it did. And they say there's no atheists in foxholes, and I certainly agree with that, because I did an awful lot of praying.
I believe it. Did you do much sleeping at all? I mean, you talk about that first night and then a second night. I mean, was it difficult to actually close your eyes and sleep?
Yes, I don't think that I really got a good sleep at all, because of the worry that you had and the shelling. It just wasn't conducive to sleeping. Actually, the second day, we'd moved up to airfield number 2, going to spend the night at that position, and then the following day, go into an attack to try to take Hill Peter, which was north of the airfield. I was buddied up with one of our squad members, Joseph Bandiera. We started digging a foxhole or a hole so that we could get in. You know what it is like trying to dig a hole in the sand. It just keeps sliding in. I was assigned what they call a pick-matic, which was like a pick on one side and another blade on the other side of it, and that didn't work worth a darn in sand. And below us, there were two dead Marines, and they had been digging in to make a foxhole. They didn't have helmets. I don't know what happened to them, or whether the Japanese got them or what, but they're bareheaded, and the one had a shovel, so I had that pick-matic. Well, that wasn't doing any good, so I went down, and I got the shovel from the one Marine there that was dead, so that worked quite a bit better to get our hole dug. And about the time that we got it deep enough for Bandiera and I to get into, there was a stretcher party that came down over the bank, and we, of course, helped them get down. And when they got through, traveling through our area, they had caved in all of our hard work. We didn't have any coverage. And just shortly after the stretcher party went through, we got some mortar shells in, or artillery shells. And, of course, we both dived for the hole. Well, I was a little slower than Bandiera, and I ended up on top of him in this hole, and it wasn't quite deep enough because my buttocks was above ground level. Well, we got these artillery shells, and a piece of shrapnel hit me in the buttocks, and it stung, but it didn't break the skin. It just hit flat, I guess. So after that shelling, we started digging again, and we finally got the hole deep enough for both of us. After we'd gotten in the hole, and of course it had turned dark, and they were sending up star flares that would float down. And as they floated down, they would, of course, oscillate, and the light hit these two Marines, dead Marines, in the hole below us. And the way the flare was going back and forth, it caused shadows on the guys' heads, and it made it look like they were moving, and that was really a scary thing.
Well, the whole thing sounds like a scary thing, and I don't want to lose sight of the fact that you're still a very young man. What were you, 19 years old?
Well, I was at that time, about 18, 19.
And what was your realistic expectation in facing all of that, even just in 2 days that you've described for us of combat on Iwo Jima? Did you really think you were going to make it out of there alive?
Well, of course, hope springs eternal, and I was certainly hoping so. And after seeing so many casualties, it certainly put some doubt in your mind. Anyway, the following morning, we went into the attack to take this high ground. And, of course, the Japanese were firing down on us from this elevation, and we had to cross this open area. I saw Westberg, who was in our squad. I saw him get hit, and his ammo cans fly. And shortly after that, I was just about to dive in a hole, and when I was hit, the bullet, the angle was I was running in, and the angle that the Japanese were shooting at us, the bullet came right down by my head and right down along the inside of my leg, not penetrating, but just grazing me. And then it hit in my next to my heel and then in my ankle and just went on and into the ground. So it was just one of those what we term $1 million wound. It wasn't serious enough, but it was serious enough that it got me out of combat.
Yeah, it didn't threaten your life necessarily, but it made it so you couldn't fight anymore.
Yeah, and had I been just a few inches to my left, it would have hit me right in the head. But fortunately, it you know, I was in that angle where it didn't hit me directly.
Well, and it sounds like that the angle that they were shooting at you from was pretty much right on top of you, so your head was the biggest target.
Well, I have a big head anyway.
What did that feel like? Were you in pain?
Actually, it felt like I'd been hit with a baseball bat. When I landed in the hole, I landed on top of my left foot, and of course it was all numb, and I was a little leery of looking at it, but I moved it out from under me, and I could see that, you know, it was a grazing wound. So I, of course, all carried a little first aid packet with a compress in there and some sulfa powder. And so I applied that to the wound. The Japanese, he was still firing at me even though I was in that hole. So I realized that this compress that I'd used was white and showed up quite nicely, you know, for a target. So I had a mosquito head net, camouflage mosquito head net in my pack. So I took that out and wrapped that around the white bandage so that it blended in a lot better. A corpsman came up and checked me, and he said, well, you've done everything I can do for you. He said, I'll write your tag out and tag you. We have more serious to the wounded up in front, so you'll have to make your way back to an aid station. So I would get up and I'd run a little bit, and the Jap would fire at me, and I'd throw myself on the ground and roll. And I finally worked my way back to a point where I was out of the range of the Japanese that was firing at me. I hobbled as best I could over somebody who was in our squad who had seen me going back, said they never saw anyone run so fast in one leg in their life. Anyway, I got back to the point where there were some walking wounded that were heading to the aid station, and they assisted me in getting down to the aid station where a surgeon or the doctor there checked me out. I waited there until they called them ducks. They're amphibious vehicles that they had, and so they loaded me on one of those with several other wounded. And I remember one of the corpsmen, he said, this man that's next to you, he told me to hold his hand. He had what we term shell shock. He would least bit of noise and he would shake, but when you held his hand, it gave him a sense of security, even though he was out of it, so to speak. Anyway, we went out to what had been a troop transport, but they converted it to a hospital ship. So they hauled me up on a crane on the stretcher, and then they took me down into the aid station in there. And as I was lying on the stretcher, I heard someone say, hey, Carl, and here it's Westwood, who I'd seen get hit earlier. He was waiting to go in to have the wound cleaned and so forth. And so, anyway, that was quite a coincidence to see him there.
Well, I'm just guessing, but I imagine you probably also saw a lot of guys who were in worse shape than you were.
Oh, very much so. Well, there was one young man that had quite a wound in his leg. Another young man had opened his mouth to yell and had a bullet go right through his jaws without injuring anything, without hitting his teeth or anything. So you talk about lucky, he certainly was. It knocked him out, but then he came to and ended up on the same ship that I was for medical aid.
And how long were you on the hospital ship? How long were you in the hospital period? How long was it before you could walk normally again?
Well, the ship that we were on, when it was had its full load, so to speak, we headed back to Guam, and I was in the hospital there for about a month. Then, after being released from the hospital, I went back to my division and my outfit, who had they'd returned from Iwo at that time, and I joined my old outfit again, and I developed a coral infection in the scar tissue, the wound on my heel, and as a result of that, it caused what they call a keloid condition, which resulted in me being not combat efficient. So I was then transferred to the personal effects section, and until I had enough points built up to return to the States.
So when I asked you how long it was till you could walk normally again, was that a trick question? Is the answer never? I mean, is this something that has bothered you to some extent ever since?
Well, to a point, I can walk okay, but that, of course, that scar tissue can break open quite easily, even now. In our initial machine gun squad, we had 100% casualty, but no what we term KIAs, or killed in action. Every one of the original squad was wounded, but we didn't lose anyone, which is very unusual.
Very unusual. And how many guys in your squad?
I believe, if I remember correctly, about seven. And like I say, I saw several of them get wounded before I did. And like I say, fortunately, none of us were killed of the original squad.
You went back to Iwo Jima for the 50th anniversary of the battle. So this is 1995 we're talking about. What did you do there? What did you see? And what did it mean to you?
Well, of course, we flew in. They took us by truck to, well, I guess, first of all, to Suribachi. And so we got to get to the top of Suribachi and see the memorial up there. And then later that day, they had a joint service with the Japanese. They had a presentation of flags and so forth, which was quite moving for all of us. Then after that, we continued a little tour of the island. We got to see into some of the caves and enforcement that they had. Then later in the day, they flew us back to Guam. But it was certainly a gut-wrenching day, because you remembered all the sad things, and also there were some good things, too, that came to mind.
Well, and I don't know where all you went on your little tour, but did you ever get close enough that you could see the spot where you'd been hit?
No, quite frankly, it. For one thing, over the period of years, the vegetation had grown back, whereas when I was there, everything was just barren. Yeah. All the shelling and everything had just knocked everything down. Airfield 1, where we'd gone for the first night, was no longer in existence. But Airfield 2 was. We did drive by it, but I couldn't really determine where it was that I'd been hit on, as far as the location on the field.
You know, I often ask vets if they've been to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial. But in your case, I wonder even more, have you been to Washington, D.C. to see the Marine Corps Memorial with that giant statue of the Marines lifting the flag atop Suribachi?
Well, I did see that. I went on that honor flight. We did get to see the flag-raising memorial, but unfortunately, I couldn't get in. They didn't have any facilities for me to get into the Marine base there or the Marine Museum, which I have loved to have seen.
Well, I've got two questions for you on that. At the National World War II Memorial, looking at that wall of gold stars, representing 406,000 Americans who died, so many of them your fellow Marines at Iwo Jima. What did you think of when you were looking at that?
Well, it, of course, brought back a lot of memories of the guys I've associated with. I realized what the number of losses that we were, just how serious things were. It was quite an experience to go back to see that.
Was there a thought at all of, if I had been a few inches to the left, I'd be part of one of those stars?
That entered my mind also. Yeah, but the good Lord had other things for me to do, I guess.
It all happened 75 years ago this week, and maybe you've got a little better understanding of the sacrifice it took and the lasting effect it has had. Again, link to the complete original interviews with these three World War II Iwo Jima survivor Marines at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.